Chapter 1. Chumbe Island, Zanzibar, Tanzania. The sharks darted at the edges of their vision, sleek gray shapes that offered Sam and Remy Fargo only glimpses of knife-edged fins and flicking tails before disappearing into the curtain of swirling sand. As usual, Remy had refused to pass up the photo opportunity, and as usual, she'd asked Sam to serve as scale as she focused her high-speed underwater camera past him and at the feeding frenzy. For his part, Sam was less worried about the sharks than he was the precipice at his back, 150-foot drop off the sandbank into the dark deep of the Zanzibar Channel. Remy pulled her face up from the camera, smiled with her eyes behind the mask, and gave him an okay sign. Sam thankfully finned forward to join her. Together they knelt in the sand and watched the show. It was July off the coast of Tanzania, which meant monsoon season, which in turn meant the warm East African coastal current, EACC, was surging from the southeast until it met the southern tip of Zanzibar, where it split into inshore and offshore currents. For sharks, this created a food funnel in the 18-mile gap between Zanzibar and the mainland as prey fish were driven northward. An irresistible moving buffet, Remy called it. Sam and Remy took care to stay within what they'd dubbed the safe zone, that 50-yard crystal-clear water strip off Chumbe Island. Past that was the drop into the channel. The demarcation was hard to miss. The current, moving at 6 knots or more, threw up a roiling curtain of sand as it scraped along the island's sandbar. This Sam and Remy had dubbed the goodbye zone. Step into this rip current without a safety line, and you were in for a one-way trip up the coast. Despite the danger, or perhaps because of it, this yearly trip to Zanzibar was one of their favorites. Along with sharks, prey fish, rip currents, and underwater sandstorms that lasted for months, the EACC offered up treasure, albeit usually bits and pieces worth nothing more than their curiosity factor, but this was enough for Sam and Remy. Over the centuries, ships had been plying Africa's east coast from Mombasa to Dar es Salaam, many of them laden with gold and gems and ivory bound for colonial empire cities. Countless ships had sunk in and around the Zanzibar Channel, the contents of their holds spilled along the bottom, just waiting for the right current to uncover or move them within reach of curious divers, such as the Fargos. Over the years, they'd recovered gold and silver coins from the Roman Empire to Spain, Chinese ceramics, Sri Lankan jade, silverware. From the fascinating to the mundane, they'd uncovered it. So far on this trip, they'd found only one item of note, a diamond-shaped gold coin so barnacle-encrusted they could make out no details. Sam and Remy watched the sharks feed for a few more minutes and then, by mutual nod, turned and began finning south along the bottom, each stopping occasionally to use a ping-pong paddle to waft at the sand, hoping the lump that had caught the eye might be a hidden bit of history. Chumbe Island, roughly 6 miles long and 2 miles wide, is shaped like a woman's boot, with the shin, ankle, and forefoot facing the channel, and the back of the calf, the stiletto heel, and sole facing Zanzibar proper. Just above the ankle there was a break in the sandbar, an inlet that led to the lagoon created by the stiletto heel. After 15 minutes of trolling along the sand, Sam and Remy reached this stiletto break, then turned west until they were 10 yards off the beach, then swung north again to resume their search. Now they became more watchful. It was along this stretch of the sandbar that the main channel pushed dangerously close to the beach, a bubble-shaped salient that narrowed their safe zone to a mere 40 feet. Remy swam inshore and ahead of Sam by a few feet, each of them frequently checking to make sure the other hadn't drifted toward the precipice. In the corner of Sam's right eye, he saw a glint, a fleeting flash of gold. He stopped swimming, settled knees first into the sand, then tapped his dive knife on his tank to get Remy's attention. She stopped swimming, turned, and finned back to him. He pointed toward the spot. She nodded. With Sam in the lead, they swam toward shore until the sandbanks came into view. a wall of sand nearly 12 feet tall, these banks marked a precipice of sorts where the water depth dropped from chest height to 20 feet. They stopped before the bank and looked around. Remy shrugged. Where? Sam shrugged his shoulders and kept scanning up and down the bank. There. 20 feet to his right, he saw it again, a flash of gold. They swam to it and stopped again. Here the goodbye zone precipice was closer still, not 8 feet behind their backs. Even at this distance they could feel the surge of the current, like a vortex trying to sweep them into the deep. Jutting from the bank at waist height was what appeared to be 6 or 7 inches of a barrel's hoop. Though tarnished and fuzzy with barnacles, in a few places the hoop had been sandblasted by the current, exposing shiny metal. Sam reached out and fanned the area around the hoop. The exposed portion widened to 8 inches, then 10 inches, before curving back and disappearing into the bank. Sam moved his paddle upward, hoping to uncover some of the barrel's staves if the wood hadn't succumbed to rot. Sam stopped, fanning. He looked to Remy and saw her eyes were wide behind her mask. Above the hoop was not rotted wood, but a curved metal facade, mottled green with patina. Sam dropped to his knees and wiggled forward until his chest was nearly touching the bank, then craned his neck and waved his paddle beneath the hoop. After 30 seconds of work, a cavity appeared. Gently, slowly, Sam slipped his hand into the hollow and probed the interior with splayed fingers. He withdrew his arm and backed away from the object until he was again beside Remy. She looked at him with expectant eyes. He nodded back. There was no doubt. Their barrel wasn't a barrel, but rather a ship's bell. "Well, that was unexpected," Remy said a few minutes later after surfacing. "I'll say," Sam replied after removing his mouthpiece. Until now, the biggest artifact they'd ever found was a sterling silver trencher from a torpedoed World War II Liberty ship. She shed her fins and tossed them over the gunwale onto the afterdeck of their rental, a commuter-style 25-foot Andreal Joubert Nivelle express cruiser, complete with lacquered teak woodwork and retro subway windows, then climbed the ladder, followed by Sam. Once they'd shed the remainder of their gear and tucked it away in the Andreal's cabin, Remy fished a pair of water bottles from the ice chest and tossed one to Sam. They sat down on the deck chairs. "How long do you think it's been down there?" Remy asked. "Hard to say. Doesn't take long for patina to set in. We'd have to see the thickness of the growth on the rest of it. The interior felt fairly unblemished."
"And the clapper?" Remy asked.
"Couldn't feel it."
"Looks like we've got a decision to make."
"That we do." Not only did the Tanzanian government have some unorthodox laws when it came to maritime salvage, Chumbe Island was officially known as Chumbe Island Coral Park, a good portion of which had been partitioned as a reef sanctuary and a closed forest reserve. Before Sam and Remy could do anything, they first had to determine whether the bell officially lay within either of these protected areas. If they passed this hurdle, then they could in good conscience proceed to the next step, determining the bell's provenance and or pedigree, a requirement should they want to stake a legal claim before alerting local officials to the bell's presence. It was a tenuous tightrope on which they tread. If they reached the far side, they may have a significant historical find on their hands, but on either side of the tightrope were laws that could lead to, at best, having the find snatched away, or at worst, criminal charges. By law, they could take any found man-made objects that required no extraordinary excavation methods. Trinkets such as Remy's diamond-shaped coin were fine. A ship's bell was a wholly different matter. None of this was new to the Fargos. Together and alone, privately and professionally, Sam and Remy had been hunting for treasure, artifacts, and hidden history for most of their adult lives. Following in her father's footsteps, Remy had attended Boston College, emerging with a master's in anthropology and history, with a focus on ancient trade routes. Sam's father, who'd died a few years earlier, had been one of the lead engineers on NASA's space programs, while Sam's mother, a vivacious lady, ran a charter dive boat. Sam received an engineering degree from Caltech, along with a handful of trophies for lacrosse and soccer. While in his final months at Caltech, Sam was approached by a man he would later discover was from DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, the government's research and development arm. The lure of pure creative engineering combined with serving his country made Sam's choice an easy one. After 7 years at DARPA, Sam returned to California, where Sam and Remy met at the Lighthouse, a jazz club on Hermosa Beach. Sam had wandered into the club for a cold beer, and Remy was there celebrating a successful research trip looking into rumors of a sunken Spanish ship off Abalone Cove. Though neither of them had ever called their first meeting a case of love at first sight, they'd both agreed it had certainly been a case of pretty damn sure at first hour. 6 months later, they were married where they'd first met, in a small ceremony at the Lighthouse. At Remy's encouragement, Sam dove headfirst into his own business, and they struck pay dirt within a year with an argon laser scanner that could detect and identify at a distance mixed metals and alloys, from gold and silver to platinum and palladium. Treasure hunters, universities, corporations, and mining outfits scrambled to license Sam's invention, and within 2 years, Fargo Group was seeing an annual net profit of $3 million. Within 4 years, the deep-pocketed corporations came calling. Sam and Remy took the highest bid, sold the company for enough money to see themselves comfortably through the rest of their lives, and then turned to their true passion, treasure hunting. For Sam and Remy, the engine that drove their lives was not money, but rather the adventure and the satisfaction of seeing the Fargo Foundation flourish. The foundation, which split its gifting among underprivileged and abused children, animal protection, and nature conservancy, had grown in leaps and bounds over the last decade, the previous year donating almost $20 million to a variety of organizations. A hefty part of that money had come from Sam and Remy personally, and the rest of it from private donations. For better or worse, their exploits attracted a fair amount of media attention, which in turn attracted wealthy, high-profile donors. The question they now faced was whether this ship's bell was something they could turn into philanthropic funds or simply a fascinating historical diversion. Not that it mattered, of course. The pursuit of hidden history held its own joys for them. Either way, they knew where they had to start. "Time to call Selma," Remy said. "Time to call Selma," Sam agreed. An hour later, they were back at their rented plantation-style bungalow at Kendwa Beach on Zanzibar's northern tip. While Remy prepared a fresh fruit salad, slices of prosciutto and mozzarella, and iced tea, Sam dialed Selma. Above their heads, a 60-inch ceiling fan churned the air, while through the French doors, a cool offshore breeze billowed the gauze curtains. Despite it being 4 a.m. in San Diego, Selma Wondrash picked up on the first ring. Sam and Remy were not surprised, having come to believe Selma slept only 4 hours a night, save Sundays, when she slept 5.
"The only time you call me when you're on vacation is when you're in trouble or about to get into trouble," Selma said over the speakerphone without preamble.
"Not true," Sam replied. "Last year from the Seychelles we called because a troop of baboons had broken into your beach house, destroyed the furniture, and made off with all your worldly goods, and the police thought you were burglars."
"She's right," Remy mouthed from across the kitchen island. Using the tip of her knife, she tossed Sam a chunk of fresh pineapple. He caught it in his mouth, and she applauded silently.
"Okay, that's true," Sam told Selma. A former Hungarian citizen who'd never quite lost her accent, Selma Wondrash was the stern but secretly soft-hearted head of Sam and Remy's 3-person research team behind the Fargo Foundation. Selma was widowed, having lost her husband, an Air Force test pilot, in a crash 10 years earlier. After finishing her degree at Georgetown, Selma had managed the Library of Congress's Special Collections Division until Sam and Remy lured her away. More than a research chief,
Selma had proven herself a superb travel agent and logistics guru, getting them to and from destinations with militaristic efficiency. Selma ate, drank, and lived research. The mystery that stubbornly refused solution, the legend that showed the barest spark of truth.
"So what is it this time?" Selma asked.
"A ship's bell," Remy called. They could hear the fluttering of paper as Selma retrieved a fresh legal pad.
"Tell me," she said.
"West coast of Chumbe Island," Sam said, then recited the coordinates he'd locked into his GPS unit before heading for the boat.
"You'll have to check boundaries of the reserves and sanctuaries, yes," Selma said, her pencil rasping on paper. "I'll have Wendy look into Tanzanian maritime law. Anything else?"
"A coin. Diamond-shaped, about the size of a U.S. half-dollar. We found it about 120 yards north of the bell." Sam looked to Remy for confirmation of this and got a nod in return. "We're going to see if we can clean it up a bit, but the face is obscured right now."
"Got it. Next."
"There's no next. That's it. As soon as possible, Selma. The sooner we can put a hook on that bell, the better. That sandbank didn't look all that stable."
"I'll get back to you," Selma replied, and hung up.